Okay, back to our examination of Christology, study of Christ, the study of the Son of God who entered into his world and as creator. And I'm grateful to Brian for filling in for me last week. Had a good opportunity to go down to Florida and see the grandchild, so we took it. Since I had already planned for Carrie to be in the pulpit, I didn't have to prepare a sermon, so it was a good week to escape and go see the kids. So thanks, Brian, for stepping in for me in the matter of the humiliation of Christ as one of the states of Christ. And I'll come back to that thought in a moment. But I want to do something, and this is no reflection upon what Brian taught last week, because frankly, I didn't hear what he taught, so I don't know what he said. So it's not a reflection in any way upon his abilities or inabilities or content whatsoever. I'm sure he did just wonderfully, as I've heard from a number of sources. But I want to go back to something prior to the states of Christ, back before this, when we were talking about the nature of Christ, and we were talking about the various realities having to do with Jesus and his unipersonality. Remember that discussion? The nature of Jesus as the Son of God with the person of the Son of God and the person of a human, right? So we have the singular person of the Son of God with the natures of God and man. Okay. I'll make sure I didn't say that wrong and set myself back on everything I taught. Okay, now one of the things that I wanted to bring up as a part of that discussion, and the reason I want to do so is because it's extremely popular, is the various ways of thinking having to do with the natures of Christ through what is known as a canonic theory lens, okay? And this will be relevant for what we're going to be talking about tonight. And I realized as I was going back to my outline that this very much fits into what we're going to be talking about here in a moment. When I talk about a canonic theory, I'm talking about a view of Philippians 2 in which this idea of the Son of God emptying himself of the divine in order to take on humanity. Because the real struggle with this unipersonality of Christ is, how do we understand the idea of a human being being in personality one, meaning the very nature of God himself, the very person of God himself, and yet having two distinct natures of both human and divine? They don't seem to mix very well, do they? I mean, it's oil and water, really. I mean, how do you put omnipresence with the limitations of human beings? Because, as most of you moms know, you can't be in two places at once, right? And yet, the omnipresent God can be everywhere. Those two things seem to struggle as part of the problem. So, what has been put forward over the years is a number of various theories of how this can be related to one another, but one of the most popular is called the canonic theory. And the canonic theory, I think, frankly, in much of Baptist life, has become the de facto standard. I don't know if you agree with me on that, but I've seen it. In the sense that the only way that modern Christians can seem to understand this is to say, well, what God did was he gave up certain of his divine attributes in order to become human. Okay, the canonic theory. Kenosis is that the Logos, the Son of God, voluntarily laid aside various aspects of his divine nature in order to assume a human form. And the idea is basically, well, I can understand that he's fully God and fully man in this sense. He's fully human because he takes on human form, but he takes the various elements of his divinity and he kind of just lays them aside and he doesn't exercise them anymore. Because as a human being, how does a human being exercise omnipresence? Right? And so the way to understand this is to say, well, what the Son did was he just laid aside omnipresence. He said, well, I have the prerogative to use that, but I'm not going to. In fact, in the great hymn, I forget which one it is. I always forget the title. It's this idea of emptied himself of all but love. Remember that line? I forget what song it's in, but okay. The picture of God, the Son, emptying himself. Well, that's specifically contrary to Chalcedon, the discussion we were having earlier, okay? The canonic theories are, in fact, a repudiation of Chalcedon, because Chalcedon's position was that in Jesus, the fullness personality of God is present, and both the nature of divinity and humanity and all of what those two things are joined together in this one person. The canonic theory says, well, to kind of figure this out, we'll just let the divine side kind of disappear, and then when he ascends back to heaven, we'll pick that up again, right? Or Jesus will pick that up. And in fact, what he'll really do, if you really extend the canonic theories out, is he'll lay aside his human nature at that point and take on the divine. But both of those deny Chalcedon. Because what Chalcedon argued is, nope, in Jesus, the fullness of humanity and the fullness of divinity are present. And this Jesus exercised his prerogatives to use both his human and divine attributes during the course of his life. Or the way that Dr. Kimbrell has told it to me for years and years and years, the child lying in the manger was holding together the manger underneath him. Using his human side, where he's laying there as a baby, crying, needing to be changed into the whole nine yards, and yet at the same time is holding together the universe underneath him. That's the picture of Chalcedon. The canonic theories move away from that. And I think the reason why we need to stress this is because when we talk to fellow believers about the nature of Jesus, if you ever get into these kind of conversations, we need to hold fast these ideas of who this Jesus is. Because if we don't, it produces problems in our discussion of the states of Jesus in his humiliation and in his exaltation. And I'll show you a specific example a little bit later. For example, there's a number of buts that I've written down here in relation to this idea of kenosis. The idea of a canonic emptying by the Logos of his divine prerogatives is based, in fact, in many senses, as Burkhoff notes, on a pantheistic view of God. And a pantheistic view of God and man in which they are not so absolutely different, but that the one can be transformed into the other. If you think about it. Because here's God saying, I want to become man, but the way to become man then is to actually give up my divine side, which means that God can change. That the person of God can give up being the very nature of God in order to become a human. Well, that's pantheistic in its approach, really. If you think about it, it's saying that the immutable God, who has been the same yesterday, today, and forevermore, well, for 33 years, though, he changed. No. Because any assessment of that would pull into this pantheistic idea. Secondly, as I just said, it's altogether subversive of the doctrine of immutability. The nature of God cannot change, thus the nature of God entering into human being cannot be changed to fit. Any view that you have of the nature of Jesus Christ has got to admit, if you're going to call him the Son of God, then you have to be willing to admit that he was in fact able to use all of the prerogatives of divinity. Otherwise, he's not the Son of God. He's changed. It also, unfortunately, destroys the doctrine of the Trinity. And this is one of those connections I'm not sure that I've ever noticed before. But given the fact that so few people have a robust understanding of the Trinity in our age, is it possible that the reason that they don't is because they have a sub-view of the incarnation itself? The reason why people misunderstand the Trinity is because they misunderstand the incarnation, not the other way around. That in fact, when we talk about Jesus having given up or the Son of God, I should say, having given up some of the divine attributes in order to become human, it says that the humanized Son, self-emptying of his divine attributes, could no longer be considered a part of the Trinity itself. I mean, is he really a part of the Trinity if he's not really fully God in every sense? Can he really stand there and say, Father? Can he really say, I'm going to send the Spirit? Can he really say that? Or can he really more say, well, I'm hoping to do that because I'm not really exercising my divine prerogatives here because I've given those up, right? It destroys the very essence of the Trinity. And the fact is that the canonic theories do not solve the problem of how deity could enter into humanity because the deity in question is no longer God. It doesn't really solve the problem. It creates a new one. So, when we have people talk about Jesus as God, but God without all the requisite attributes of being God anymore, we're talking about someone who isn't God, no matter how hard you might try to make that case. The only way that Jesus can be truly God and truly man is if in his personality as the Logos, he can in fact exercise both and fully all of what it means to be God and all of what it means to be a man. And that is the essence of the God-man. Now, like I said, I think the de facto standard in our day is that the vast majority of Christians, having never actually had a discussion about the dual nature of Jesus, never been taught it, because look, theology classes in Baptist churches are virtually non-existent, right? So you have the average Christian sitting in the pew, listening to all the moralistic therapeutic deism they're getting from the pulpit. They haven't got a clue who Jesus really is. And so they just make it up as they go. Because they don't have any choice. Because they're not being taught differently. And the natural inclination of human beings is to say, how can God fit in a human carcass? Well, God must have just become less than God in order to become one of us. That's the de facto choice. That's a mistake. And I would argue that it's actually heresy. Because it denies Chalcedon. Because it denies the orthodoxy of a full God. You bet it is. That's correct. It's Arianism at its very core. So, in other words, I brought that back to you because I really want you to keep that in mind as I move forward. Now, I don't think that Brian did this. If he did, okay. It'll be a repetition. Hopefully he did. But I want to talk about the states of Christ, or when I say states, I'm using the plural in this sense, but it really only involves two. A state of humiliation and a state of exaltation. All right, now let's talk about what a state is. A state is a position in life. A position in existence. You have a state of being. Okay? It's fairly straightforward, right? You have a state. You exist in a certain state. Elements exist in a certain state. They're either gas, they're liquid, they're solid. They're in a certain state. I know modern science has come up with new ones, but no. I was educated in the 70s, okay? Back when there were three states! It's a position. It's a status in existence. And in this case, it's particularly the forensic relationship in which one stands to the law. The law. Okay, the key idea in these issues of exaltation and humiliation is the law. And I know Brian touched on this and dealt with it. Where do we stand in relationship to the law? Now remember, we've talked about the law being the very nature of God himself, extended into a set of requirements upon humanity, right? So the law is the very nature of God himself. All right. So the state of, is the state of the law itself, this thing that governs the universe, which comes from the very essence of God. So we can call it a state of innocence, or we can call it a state of guilt, right? You exist in one of those two states in relation to the law. Now, in contrast to a state, then, is a condition. A condition. In your state, what conditions are you experiencing in that state? What mode do you have in that existence? Especially as determined by the circumstances of your life. For example, you've been found guilty by a court of law. You are now in a state of guilt. Now, you will experience different conditions based upon that guilt. You now will go to jail. You will go to prison. You will lose your freedom. You'll have other conditions that'll come upon you. After you are released from prison, you'll become an ex-con or an ex-felon or whatever. So there'll be certain realities that'll be true of you in this overarching state of guilt. Right? Now, I realize that in a perfect world, innocent people don't go to prison. So an innocent person should not be in prison. A guilty person should be in prison. If everything worked the way it's supposed to, in theory, that's what we would be talking about. So when we talk about state versus condition, we're talking about first an ontological reality, right? I mean, even he got it, yeah. An ontological reality, what it means to be something, and then what it means as a result of that being. That's the conditions underneath. Now, in the case of Christ, it is the states that are more significant, which magnify the conditions. Jesus, in his two states, either a state of humiliation or a state of exaltation, has different conditions in each one of those based on that state. Different conditions that would be true about him as a result of being in that particular state. Okay? Christ was humiliated and exalted as a state of being, with the resultant conditions, including his incarnation, his birth, his life, his death, his burial, his resurrection, his ascension, his session, and his return. All of those are conditions underneath one of these two states. So, in a linear sense, because we're linear, the Logos of God was in a state of being divine. Then, he entered into a state of humiliation. But then, he entered into a state of exaltation. In which case, there were certain conditions true of him in each of those states. Now, we really don't talk much about the divine state prior to his humiliation, prior to his incarnation, although the entire Christological discussion is that, right? Who is this Son of God, right? Okay, so the divine state is just part of our discussion of God. Who is God? So what we're talking about is this humiliation of Jesus, the Son of God entering into a state of humiliation and the various realities that go with that, and then the state of exaltation and the various realities that go with that. All right. Now, so in his humiliation, then Christ experienced all the conditions of being under the law. In his exaltation, then Christ experiences all the conditions of being free from the law. Or a better way of saying is having accomplished all that the law requires that was imposed upon Adam, that Adam failed. Okay? So, in terms of the law, because this is the dividing line, by the way, of these two conditions, is either he's under the law or he's been set free from it. He's been exalted because of his success at keeping the law and doing what the law commands. So he's a relationship to the law. And that's why I use the illustration, by the way, of a guilty man versus an innocent man, because you have a man under the law who is being judged according to the law, and he's living under that law in his state of humiliation, accomplishing what the law requires, and then that becomes his exaltation. It's because he was successful at keeping the law that Christ was exalted. It's because he did what his Father told him to do, successfully and absolutely, which allowed him then to be exalted. Notice the conditions based upon the state. In his state of humiliation or in his state of exaltation. All right, you tracking with me so far? Make sense? Now, what Brian did last week is he touched on a number of aspects of the humiliation or the conditions related to the state of humiliation. And if I remember your outline right, Brian, you talked about the incarnation and the birth of Christ. You talked about his sufferings, both in this life and within the cross, right? You talked about his death. You talked about his burial. Okay. Fine. It's closely connected to the death. We'll leave it there because I assumed you did. I didn't write anything about it. I will say only this much. It is essential to Christian orthodoxy that the dead Jesus was buried. The scriptures make a great deal out of the fact that Joseph of Arimathea came, took the body, and buried it in a tomb, and that that tomb was sealed and that tomb was guarded. Okay, because that's the precursor, by the way, to the whole issue of his resurrection. All right. So Christian orthodoxy doesn't see Jesus tossed somewhere, you know, on a scrap pile, which, by the way, most crucifixion victims were. In the first century, most crucifixion victims were taken down, thrown into a pit, covered over. Because they specifically, the Romans, specifically wanted the shame of the death of crucifixion to continue into burial. Burial was considered to be something that you sort of honored the victim with. But if he's been crucified, there's no honor to be added here. Okay, that's part of all of this. It's interesting, as we go into Holy Week and we start talking about death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, we'll have more conversations, I hope, about Jesus' burial. But I want to go to one additional state of humiliation that goes just after the burial. You're thinking, there's another one? He's dead and buried. What else could there be? The Apostles' Creed has an interesting little phrase in it after it says, we believe in this Jesus who was crucified, died, and was buried. And the next sentence says, he descended into, and then there's a word that's used there, which is difficult to translate. And it's a word which typically is translated hell. He descended into hell, but it could be translated Hades or the lower regions or the earth or the dead even. He descended into the dead, something to that effect. Okay, it's a difficult word to translate, and none of the guys that wrote it are here to explain it, so we're kind of like left to figure it out. But that's an interesting phrase, isn't it? He was crucified, which means he went through the act of execution. He died, which was the result of it. He was taken down and buried. But now the creed adds an additional thing, an additional humiliation that he suffered. Now, the question is what does it mean? So I'll rephrase it this way, in the form of a question. Did Jesus, after his death and burial, go to hell? Okay. You say no? Okay? Now, the problem we have with that is it's a bit problematic with this, right? I mean, it does say he descended into hell, and it's after his burial, which is a logical connection for us to say, well, wait a minute, that's what happens to people when they die in sin, when they die under the wrath of God, guess where they go? And so there have been many have said, yeah, that's exactly what it means. In fact, in Catholic theology and even Lutheran theology, the idea is that he did, in fact, descend into hell. That he went into the place of where the unsaved dead are. Some, yeah, Pentecostals do as well. Right. I wrote a paper on this, actually. You can find it on my website. It's called A Critique Regarding Jesus' Descent into Hades. One of the very first questions I got as a pastor of a church in 2001 was this particular question. So I wrote a paper on it in order to try to answer the question. There are four specific passages of Scripture I'd like you to look at as to where this idea comes from. Okay? The first is Ephesians 4:9. We've been in Ephesians and we've seen this verse before. I didn't spend a great deal of time on it when I preached Ephesians 4, but you can see how it has this sort of thing in it. It says in verse 9, let me go back to verse 8. Therefore it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. Then most modern translations have a parenthesis starting in verse 9. In saying he ascended, what does it mean but that he also descended into the lower regions, the earth? He who descended is the one who also ascended far above all the heavens that he might fill all things. And it's that little word, descended into the lower regions. Lower regions is that word in Greek that we struggle with trying to understand. What is Paul talking about here? Is Paul suggesting here that, well, the one who ascended is the one who descended, and he went down into the lower regions. So from our vantage point, he ascended, right? Therefore, what Paul must be suggesting is from our vantage point, he descended. That is the question, isn't it? Yeah. See, the problem is the lexicon allows for that interpretation. Part of the problem. That's part of the problem, is it does allow for this. I mean, the modern translation is lower regions. I don't know what the King James has here, but the issue is that this is a word that we struggle to understand. But you'll notice I made a presupposition when I said, from our vantage point, he ascended. From our vantage point, he descended. But am I right in suggesting that this verse is being written from our perspective? And the answer is no, I'm not. Because what is being said here is that this Jesus is the one who descended from a different vantage point. And what vantage point is that? From heaven's vantage point. What if the ascension and descension in this verse has to do with Jesus, the Logos, coming down from heaven to accomplish what he accomplishes and then ascends back to heaven from that vantage point? That actually makes more sense in this verse, because listen to what he says next. He says, verse 11, and he gave the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the shepherds, and the teachers. What's the point? This one who came down and went back up was accomplishing in his work all that would be necessary to establish the church, and he possesses, by virtue of his descension and his ascension, all of the authority to establish these positions. It says nothing here about him having an authority based on the fact that he went to hell. That wouldn't make an authority for him to create apostles. No, it would be an authority for him to come down from heaven and then turn around and go back. That would be a perfectly reasonable authority for him to establish these positions, don't you think? So I don't think this verse says anything at all about him going to hell. I think this verse says a great deal about him coming to earth from heaven. Second passage in 1 Peter 3.
Well, in that verse 9, though, it reminds us that if he does not save of the earth, it just says the earth.
Correct. It just says the earth. But I think that's an explanatory word added by the ESV translators to try to help us understand the lower region issue, because earth can mean dirt, right? I mean, you can dig a shovel full of earth, right? So it's not really that helpful. I think the context is much more helpful than the words themselves are. Okay, 1 Peter 3. There's a couple of these, in fact, in 1 Peter. 1 Peter 3 is the first one. 1 Peter 3:18 and following. Come on, 1 Peter 3:18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but being made alive in the spirit, in which, now here's the key phrase, he went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, because they formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is 8 persons, were brought safely through water. Now, what's the typical interpretation of this? Well, the typical interpretation of this, believe it or not, is there are people who look at this verse and say, well, here's what Jesus did. He died, and he went to hell. He went to the place, he went to the abode of the dead. He went to where the unrighteous dead are, and he preached the gospel there. In order that some in that place would believe and be saved. In other words, the interpretation here, given by some, is, well, see, what it says that he proclaimed to the spirits in prison. What prison? What spirits are in prison? Well, that would be people who are entrapped because of their sinfulness. They're in prison. And in fact, specifically notes that these are people who formerly did not obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah. So these are the antediluvian folks who were living prior to Noah, who never heard the gospel. They all perished in the flood. And so Jesus apparently went and preached to them in hell. But is that what it says? By the way, that's a very popular interpretation of this verse. But is it true? It's not, obviously. That was a trick question. It's not. Here's why it's not. Look at what Peter is actually talking about. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, be put to death in the flesh, made alive in the spirit. Go back to verse 17 then. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. The context then has to do with suffering. It has to do with the fact that Christ himself suffered, and by the way, so will you, and it's good for you to suffer, just as Jesus suffered. Okay, that's the point that Peter's making. He suffered, you suffer. Suffering's good. It molds us, it makes us into the image of our Christ. It's not pleasant, but that's okay. And what Jesus did when he suffered is that his suffering was to culminate the message that had been preached by his Spirit from before the days of Noah. Meaning that the Spirit that's being referred to here is not the Spirit of Jesus, the person, but rather the Spirit of God, who went into the world and preached through Noah to men who needed to hear it. And guess what they did with it? They ignored it. And thus they perished. They were in prison already. Meaning that they were condemned and doomed because they refused to believe. And because God had not, in fact, elect any of them to believe. And so the necessary result was, is that there was a preaching going on. Noah was doing it by the Spirit of God that was given to him. But no one was listening. No one was listening. So this spirit that this Peter's writing about here is this not the spirit of Jesus going into Hades and preaching to people who were not yet saved. Because, well, here's the problem with that. The problem with that is that would mean there's two ways to get saved. One is to believe here. The other is to wait until you get to hell and let Jesus come and preach to you again. I would take that second option, to be honest with you. Because that means I can do with this life whatever I want. Right? No. No, no, no. I don't think Paul would allow us that, right? Romans 6, right? What should we say then? Should we go on sinning? Ha! No. No. How about 1 Peter 4? Just turn a page over. 1 Peter 4. Verses 4 to 6. With respect to this, they are surprised, that is, the Gentiles that are living in their sensuality. With this respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. But they will give account to him as ready to judge the living and the dead, for this is why the gospel was preached even to those who are dead, that though judged in the flesh the way people are, they might live in the spirit the way God does. And there are actually some who would say, well, see? Here's proof in the same book that Peter understood that when Jesus died, he went and preached to those who were dead. Because it actually says he's preaching to the dead. But does that really mean what it says? Who is being preached to in these verses? Well, in this verse, who's being preached to? A whole lot of people that want you to join them in their debauchery. Right? Isn't that what it says? They are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you. They hate you because you won't join their party. Who's being preached to? Well, as Ryan put it, dead men walking. Dead men partying. Dead men filled with debauchery. They want you to join them. And what's Peter telling? Don't do that. Don't go there. This is not about Jesus preaching to dead people in the sense of going down to Hades and preaching to dead people. He's preaching to people in our day who are dead. And look, every one of you who go out and proclaim the gospel to your neighbors, you know what you're doing? You're preaching to the dead. That's why God sent Ezekiel to the Valley of the Dry Bones and said, preach to these bones. Now, can you imagine that? It's a valley of dry bones. It's not going to wake up. Well, yeah, it is. Because God can use the power of God, His Word, to actually raise dead bones to life. Psalm 16:8, however, is one that kind of has a tendency to push this as well. This is an Old Testament passage, right? So it seems to be more powerful than the rest. Blah, blah, blah. Psalm 16, verses 8 to 10. I have set the Lord always before me, because He is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. Therefore my heart is glad and my whole being rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure. For You will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let Your Holy One see corruption. And some will use this verse to say, see, Jesus went to Sheol, which is the Old Testament word for the abode of the dead, where the dead are, and God went and rescued him from that place. Right? This is prophetic, isn't it? This is prophetic language, right? It's a certain person. It's David, of course, speaking of his own condition. But in doing so, he's prophesying about the one who would come. Okay? And he uses words that would give us this. You will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let Your Holy One see corruption. And that's often, by the way, used as a reference to the idea of the resurrection. The body will not see corruption, instead it'll be raised. So some who look at this and say, well, see, the coming one will go to Sheol, but God will rescue him there. But is that what it's saying? I mean, that's how people look at it. No, I would say that what this says is that God is not, in fact, going to abandon Jesus to Sheol at all. There's a different way of reading that, to play, depending on where you put the emphasis. Depends on which syllable you put the emphasis on, right? God is not going to abandon Jesus to Sheol at all. He's not going to see corruption. Okay? So it isn't about the Messiah going there and then be rescued from the place. It's about the fact that God is not even going to let him go there at all. That's what David was really happy about, was that when he died, he wouldn't have to go to the place, to the abode of the unrighteous dead, that he would be able to go into the presence of his God. See it? So, I give you those four verses because here's what you have. You have a whole bunch of people out there that are making the claim that, well, you know, this Jesus had to do something after he died. I mean, he was in the grave for like 3 days. So he had to go somewhere. I mean, his soul left his body, right, because he died, and so he had to go somewhere. Well, there's been various interpretations of this through time. Catholics actually believe, by the way, that Jesus Christ went into limbo, to the place of the dead, to save the Old Testament saints that were there. The idea of Catholicism is that when you die in a state of grace, you, prior to Christ, you went to a place where you simply waited for the Christ to come and rescue you. So Jesus went to the place of limbo. Now, here's what's interesting. Catholics have abandoned the idea of limbo in recent years, which I find fascinating because it's been Catholic dogma for centuries. Now all of a sudden, yeah. So I'm not sure what they do with this anymore. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Lutheran theology actually believes that Christ went to the place of the dead to announce his victory over Satan. He didn't go there to preach. He didn't go there to try to save. He simply went there to announce his victory over Satan and his forces. Okay. But again, there's little biblical support for that position, but for some reason Luther embraced that. Calvin, I think, expressed what most Reformed guys, most Reformed people believe in regards to this, that Christ on the cross, this phrase, I'm referring to the phrase back in the Creed, right? He descended into hell. Calvin's position was that in that statement, what the writers are doing is they are saying, in the cross, Jesus experienced all of what hell is. He experienced all of what hell is. He was crucified. He died. He was buried. The next sentence is a summary of the previous. He descended into hell. He experienced all that hell is on the cross. He experienced all of the concepts of hell. Separation from the love of God. Abandonment by the Father. The wrath of God being poured out upon him. The anger of God for sin being put down upon him. The sense of hopelessness that exists in hell. Because when you're hanging on the cross, they nail you to a cross, there ain't much hope. Not much hope there. He experienced a lack of comfort, obviously. The physical pain and suffering that would be as a result of being on the cross certainly would be a picture of the lack of comfort that will be in hell. And I think most importantly for hell, a lack of companionship. A lack of the relational things that in the Imago Dei give us a sense of security and hope and comfort in this world. We have relationships with other people and with God. But hell will be a place of utter loneliness. Because if there is companionship, that provides comfort and hope. No, what you're going to be left with in hell is you standing, if you are in hell, you are standing there in your utter rebellion against God without any of the constraints of common grace upon you, in which you stand and shake your fists at the heaven and say, I will not submit to you, and experience in that all of what it means to stand under God's wrath in his law. I shudder to think of it, to be honest with you. But Jesus on the cross experienced all of it. All of it was real as he hung there that afternoon. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why hast thou abandoned me? I mean, he had no friends. They all ran off. He had no hope. He knew he was going to die. Physical death was coming. It was only a matter of time. And the reality was that he experienced in that all of the wrath of God poured out upon him, because the scripture says he became, ontologically, he became sin for us. He didn't just have sin put on him. He became it in the sense that his physicalness on that cross looked to God as sin. And God took out his wrath upon him. So, in this final state of humiliation, Jesus didn't just die and was buried. But really, to wrap up the state of humiliation is to say that this Jesus experienced in his life, death, burial, all of that which sent him to the lowest possible place in all of creation. There's no place lower to go. Sheol is not low enough for where Christ actually went. He went from being, and this is what we need to consider, especially on Good Friday, he went from being the exalted God of the universe with all of the power and glory and majesty of the Almighty, to being an utterly worthless, rejected, murdered human being. The distance between those two points is infinite. That's what he experienced. That's his humiliation. But he had to go all through that in order to be exalted. So when we think of his life and all of what he had to suffer in terms of his temptations, and all he had to deal with in terms of the suffering of his crucifixion, and all of the pain that he went through as a part of that emotional, spiritual, physical pain he went through on the cross, it was all culminated in this idea that by the time it was over and they slammed that rock shut across the front of that tomb, he had reached the lowest place that any human being would ever go. No place lower. No place lower for anyone. And Satan danced on the roof of that tomb, believing that he had won. I sent him to the lowest place possible. And when we really get that into our head and really understand that, changes entirely our view of the atonement. Changes entirely what it is for this one to be our substitute. See? He didn't just suffer. He went further down into the abyss, if you will, than anyone's ever gone. This isn't about preaching to antediluvian saints. This is about a man who experienced the worst that any human being could ever imagine. Or dare I say it this way? What Adam brought into this world, by virtue of his sin, Christ experienced all of it. All the way down. As far down as it is possible for the curse to go, there Jesus went. Think about that during Holy Week.